There were a lot of big oil people at the December 11th Beaufort Sea Oil and Gas Lease Sale in Fairbanks, representatives from Exxon, Ohio, Mobil, Shell, Texaco, and so on, all hoping to get a piece of the action. And there was also Cliff Berglund, a local land consultant and oil lease broker who has been actively involved in oil and gas leases in the state since 1952. He represented a group of private citizens, each of whom had anteed up a minimum of $10,000 for a chance to win one of the federal and state tracts being offered. As it turned out, Berglund and his group did quite well. Of the 200 bids offered on the state tracts, he was responsible for 41 of them, and of those, he and his group were the sole bidders on 7. Commissioner of Natural Resources Robert Loresch recently announced that all bids received on state tracts were accepted, which is noteworthy given the discrepancy between Berglund's bids and those of the oil companies. When his bid for Tract 81 was read, the only bid for that parcel, $14,312.05, the subdued group assembled in the ballroom of the Travelers Inn burst into applause. The previous tract, number 80, had received 5 bids, with the highest belonging to a consortium of biggies, Mobil, Phillips, and Chevron, and that went for more than $2 million. On another tract, later in the proceedings, the discrepancy between Berglund's bid of $28,466.45 and the apparent highest bid of $47,442,185.57 from a consortium of Ohio and 3 regional native corporations drew rumbles. None of Berglund's bids went much over $28,000, and one was for less than $10,000. Though the sums of money available to Berglund aren't as impressive as those offered by the oil companies, he feels that as an independent, he has certain advantages, such as flexibility.
With me, it's easy. I either like the area and I put my money down and get a lease. But for them to get a lease, they have to, depending on where their home office is, they have to go from the area to Anchorage to maybe Houston to New York, back to Houston, back to Anchorage, and I forget which oil company person made the comment. He says, by the time we get permission to lease the area, we'll Berglund has it all.
Although Berglund lost money in his first foray into oil and gas leases, a 1952 sale in the Gulf of Alaska, since then his fortunes have improved. Take 1967, for example, when he and partner Tom McLouch purchased 2 blocks of land adjacent to Prudhoe Bay.
I could write a book about those 2 leases. We paid $1 an acre for those leases as a bonus. But directly to the south of us, the major oil companies only paid $1.50, and they're I'm sure going to take billions of dollars worth of oil out of their tracks, and already are, as a matter of fact. So I don't feel too guilty about. And at that time, there was only one well being drilled in the whole North Slope, and it was sort of a last gasp effort by ARCO and Exxon jointly, and that was, of course, the famous Prudhoe Bay well and the Discovery well. If that well had not have been a producer or a Discovery well, we would have lost.
Berglund was also involved in the 1969 sale, but he feels that since only fringe areas were available, the bulk of the good stuff having been sold in 67, the $900 million was not well spent. On the tract that he picked up in 69, he paid lease rental for 10 years and let it lapse this past October. But now he's involved again.
There was a great deal of interest in this most recent sale. People were very excited about the possibilities. Did you, having been involved for such a long time in oil and gas activities in Alaska, have that same excitement?
Yes, it's those competitive bid sales are always exciting, and had this been handled differently, it would have brought in more money than any other competitive bid sale that had ever been held prior to that anywhere in the world.
When you say handled differently?
Well, this was a very complex sale. There were, I think, 6 different bidding possibilities, and generally there's just one. And you had both the federal government and the state government involved, and generally there's just either the federal or the state government. And you had disputed tracts, and it was just a very complicated sale.
You yourself bid only on state tracts,
yes.
And your partners, I should say, state tracts that were bonus bid tracts.
Yes. Because historically, the federal government will not issue a tract to an independent that does not bid, in the millions of dollars.
Were you surprised that your bids were accepted on the 7 tracts that you were the sole bidder?
Not really, because on those particular tracks, the front end money was inconsequential because there was a sliding scale directly related to the production from the tracks, which is where the state would make the bulk of its money. And whether you bid $25,000 bonus or $140 million bonus, that would readily come back if there's production. Even $100 million you'd get back within 60 days.
On some of the tracks that you bid on, say, take number 81, where people applauded when you got that, an adjacent tract went for $6 million. Your bid was for a little over $14,000.
Yes.
It's quite a discrepancy.
Well, it's everybody but I felt that that tract was worthless.
You seem to have that intuition on a number of tracts. Somebody must have had different information.
Well, we might have had the same information, but the other people had more money.
What kinds of information do you use in selecting?
I have a geologist who rates the tracks from, you know, in this case, from 1 to 41, and we feel that we picked up some very desirable tracks geologically.
You excited about the possibility?
Yes.
You planning on drilling them yourself?
We're planning on joint venturing. In the Beaufort Sea, it costs around $300 million to fully develop one of those 5,000-acre tracts. And we can participate through, in many different ways. But the fact that the tracts are now available to be developed is a positive force as far as the state is concerned and also, the nation, really.
What's your next step?
Well, we want to get the leases issued and have them in hand, and then we'll probably talk to some of the companies that are there or that want to be there and jointly develop with them. We have the land, and they would have the money.
Have any companies approached you?
Yes.
Do you care to mention them?
No.
Berglund's total investment in the Beaufort Sea oil and gas lease sale was, by his reckoning, around $210,000, which he feels is a large sum of money to pull out of Fairbanks at this time. Money aside, oil development in this state is something that Cliff Berglund intends to stay involved with. Asked what future he sees for oil and gas activity in Alaska, he replied,
I won't even preface this by saying I think that Alaska has one of the greatest potentials for oil development in the world. I know it does.
Alaska produces 2% of the world's total supply of oil, most of that from Prudhoe Bay. The average well produces 3,500 barrels of oil a day, compared with the average well in the United States that produces 20 barrels a day. Berglund feels that the security of the nation and even the world could depend on developing Alaska's petrochemical potential. Berglund's geologist stepfather first surveyed the North Slope in the 1920s on foot, and his recommendations led to Naval Petroleum Reserve No. 4. Berglund's stepfather was also responsible for his stepson's entry into leasing in the 1952 sale. The Berglund name is likely to be associated with that activity for many years to come. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. If you live in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, you may wish you had an outhouse, at least if you've got a septic tank that needs pumping, because if you do, you're out of luck. None of the five local pumping firms will answer your call. According to spokesperson Bud Hilton of Bud Hilton's Thawing, Pumping, and Backhoe Service, quote, it's not a strike, just a slowdown for survival. Economic survival, he means. The municipal utility system has just raised the rate for dumping sewage into the city's federally funded treatment plant from $1,800 per year per truck to $181 per 1,000 gallons. Most people's tank holds between 1,000 and 1,500 gallons and needs emptying once a year. But some businesses, such as restaurants, get theirs emptied weekly. That is, any other week but this. The so-called slowdown is at its third day, and until the issue gets resolved, those 25 to 35 daily callers for pumping services will have to wait. There will be a meeting tomorrow afternoon, and if a compromise is reached then, according to Hilton, quote, the pumpers will work on a moment's notice. Hilton and the other pumpers are opposed to paying to use the facility. They feel they're being used as tax collectors for the city and would prefer to see homeowners assessed by the borough. Currently, the city does charge people hooked up to the city sewer system based on gallonage. Jim O'Neill, the city's superintendent of sanitation, says that averages $325 per year for a four-person family. According to Hilton, the new rate for dumping would raise his house calls to between $200 and $300, as opposed to the former $60 charge. And he's worried about collecting that higher rate. As he says, quote, it's not just chicken feed, it's big money. He's also worried about the big money he would be making if the system worked, sending him up into a higher, undesirable tax bracket. Although the rate of $101 per thousand gallons was based on what the city determined to be the cost of treating the sewage delivered by the pumpers, Municipal Utilities System Manager and former city mayor Harold Gillum said the fee could change, but there will still be a charge. Said Gillum on a radio talk show this morning, quote, people have to accept inflation as a way of life. And for now, some people have to accept backed-up sewage systems as a way of life, too, until the slowdown is over or they try thawing the ground in the backyard and get out those shovels. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. For the past 5 years, Lou Shapiro, a geologist with the University of Alaska's Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks, has been working full-time as a researcher on problems relating to development in the Arctic, specifically ice. The problems of strength and mechanical properties of sea ice, pressure ridges, and movement and deformation of ice in shallow water, the nearshore area usually considered to be fast ice. Most recently, he has been involved in the planning for December 11th's joint federal-state Beaufort Sea oil and gas lease sale. According to Shapiro, many of the problems associated with ice and oil activities are not immediately apparent. Coordination between industry, science, and North Slope residents have brought some of those problems to light.
We have a project that involves conducting interviews with some of the residents from the area who have experience as hunters and trappers and on the ice. Trying to get information from them and learn what they know about the about ice conditions, and somehow get that into the decision making process and get that information meshed in with ours, in trying to describe the environment that the engineers from the industry are going to have to design for.
One potential problem raised by that group of hunters and trappers concerns ice override, or EVU.
Last year we saw barrier islands just east of Barrow on the Beaufort side that were completely overridden by ice motion in mid-January or late January, which was sort of a surprise to us. We didn't think that there would be that kind of motion up there at that time of year, but at least not to that extent. So override is a real problem, and it's a known problem in the fall before the ice sets up. Before the ice is particularly thick, and there are large pileups that can develop even behind the barrier islands. That occurs at a time when the ice, however, is quite thin and quite weak. And so if given a platform in the area, a drilling structure of some sort, it would probably just pile around the structure and not do any damage. The hazard comes in the wintertime if, through some unusual circumstances, such as happened in 1977 on the islands near Barrow, when heavy ice in the wintertime begins to move, or during the spring, during breakup, when the ice is melted back, because at that time, remember, it's quite thick. The ice is not thinned appreciably, and so there's fairly heavy ice that's capable of moving through long distances in many areas up there.
Dangerous as the possibilities sound, Shapiro says that ice override is a problem that industry can handle by minimizing the potential hazard.
There are a lot of techniques that can be used, both in the construction of the structures themselves, and little manipulations, little things that can be done to the ice itself, such as cutting slots and things of that sort, to cause the ice to break and to minimize the extent of the motion, to minimize the possible effect of these overrides.
The final notice of sale for the Beaufort Sea lease contains a number of federal and state stipulations for lessees regarding the known and unknown interactions between ice and oil activity. I asked Shapiro to describe just what the ice conditions were like in the Beaufort Sea and how those conditions relate to technological concerns.
For the winter period, we recognize several zones of ice within the lease area. Against the shore is a zone that we call a bottom fast ice, which is ice that's frozen directly to the seafloor, and that, of course, is limited to areas where the water depth is less than the thickness to which the ice can freeze in a year, that is less than about 2 meters. Outside of the bottom fast ice is an area which we call a floating fast ice zone. This is relatively stable ice that freezes again to about a 6 foot thickness over the course of a year. It may have fragments of multi-year ice, heavy polar ice in it. There can be some pressure ridging within the floating fast ice zone, but usually ridges within the floating fast ice zone form early in the year at a time when the ice is thin and relatively weak, and so they don't present much of a hazard to development, to structures offshore. The floating fast ice zone falls within two specific areas. One of these is the area largely behind the barrier islands, that is, between the shore and the barrier islands. Within that area, the floating fast ice tends to be very stable once it sets up again and reaches a certain thickness of about, say, a foot or a foot and a half. It becomes quite stable because the barrier islands tend to anchor it, anchor the offshore side. Within that zone, the movements of ice that we might expect during the winter when the ice is thick and strong would be on the order of at most a few feet.
It's the floating fast ice zone outside of the barrier islands that may be cause for worry. In that area, the zone extends out to about a 13-meter depth. Ice conditions in that zone are far from stable, and as the stipulations in the notice of sale state, quote, because technology for structures in the transition ice zone has not been demonstrated in U.S. waters, particular attention will be given to structures proposed for water depths of 13 meters or more.
The outermost zone of the fast ice, or the land fast ice, is a zone of very intense ridging, and it's a zone that represents where the interaction between the pack ice and the moving pack ice and the remaining fast ice inshore occurs. And so it's a zone of very intense ridging early in the year and continuing on during a large part of the year. Large movements of ice and large pressure ridges can form there at any time of year.
A pressure ridge is a big pile of ice that forms when two ice sheets move together. The ice breaks, crushes, and piles up. If the water is shallow, eventually the piling of ice above the water drives more ice down below the water. Ultimately, it reaches the bottom, and then the piles can become quite high. Multi-year ridges, ridges that have stayed over a couple of years, are the problem. The part of the ridge that extends below the water is called a keel, and like an ice cube, that's a large percentage of its volume.
If you form a pressure ridge in shallow water, it'll just drive the ice straight down. The problem is that when the ice is moving and you have a keel that's caught in moving ice, then it can make gouges that are kilometers long. But what it'll affect is buried pipelines and so on. See, it enters into the engineering part, into the problem of engineering pipelines to carry oil from, let's say, from an offshore production platform back into back to land. The gouging problem is not a problem until that phase is reached.
Federal Stipulation 5 and State Stipulation 7 both state that all pipelines, quote, shall be designed and constructed to provide for adequate protection from water currents, storm and ice scouring, sub-freezing conditions, and other hazards as determined on a case-by-case basis. As Shapiro says, the relationship between his research and the development of technology for exploration and drilling is one where he tells the companies what the conditions are and what they have to design for, and doing that is their job. Fortunately, at least for some of that work, there are precedents in Canada.
The area behind the barrier islands, and we think in the floating fast ice out to about the 13-meter depth, is very similar, or similar in many respects, to the Mackenzie Delta area. Gravel Island technology has been used successfully for drilling in that area, and we think that Gravel Islands are a good technology for use in the certainly behind the barrier islands. We think also that they're going to be that there's no problem with their use out to a 13-meter depth. Beyond that, we would like to see a stable structure maintained in the zone of heavy ridging outside of 13 meters. We'd like to see a structure out there for a couple of years before it's drilled off, simply because that's somewhat different than the Mackenzie Delta.
The information gathered by Lou Shapiro and other scientists on the conditions present in the Beaufort Sea is in part applicable to future OCS lease sites, but the differences may outweigh the similarities.
The information about ice itself as a material will be useful because ice is ice. Sea ice is sea ice. It has properties vary with the temperature and with the salinity of the ice. But by and large, if you understand the ice in one place as a material, then you can understand it elsewhere. However, the ice conditions, of course, are different in every area. Chukchi Sea is vastly different in many ways than the Beaufort Sea is. Norton Sound is different than the Chukchi and so on. Each area has its own characteristics and each one will present its own problems.
It'll be some time yet before the problems in the Beaufort lease area are fully apparent and subsequently dealt with. And given the news releases on the shortage of available drilling rigs, operational concerns may override technological difficulties for the time being. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. three events characterized the New Year's celebrations of the Athabascan Indian village of Nulato in the 1940s, a potlatch, a dance, and a ceremony called Midzish Hokol. Those still occur today. On New Year's Day itself, then as now, a group of people go around to all the cabins in the village, as Pauline Carlo describes Midzish Hokol.
All the people would get together, the men, and go around from house to house with a canvas. And every house would donate, throw in food in this canvas that the people, it was like a blanket toss type thing, you know, where they'd all hold, make a circle and hold onto this piece of canvas and go up and down singing. Midzish Oko Hotne Hotne. Midzish Oko Hotne Hotne. So they'd go from one house to the other, and then some guys would be coming along with sleds to carry the food that's donated. And then they'd bring this to the hall, and that night they'd have, you know, a potlatch with the stuff.
So it was dancing too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mask dancing. Eskimo dancing.
In an Indian village?
In an Indian village, yes. I don't know how that started, but, you know, it's kind of strange because I don't think any Eskimo villages do have any Indian dances in their Eskimo villages, so that's kind of neat, too.
There was trading with the Eskimo village of Unalakleet, though, and it's likely that some of the ways of those coastal people, like their dances, came along with the seal oil and other trade goods. In the mask dance, as people enter the community hall wearing a mask and dressed up to confuse people as to their identity, they do an Inupiaq Eskimo-style dance as people seated behind a strip of canvas cloth strung across the hall beat on drums or empty gas cans with thin wooden wands tufted with rabbit fur. Seldom does anybody guess the dancer's identity. The mask dance usually follows the New Year's potlatch and precedes the fun dance, but in former times the potlatch was a more traditional celebration than now.
New Year's, we always had a big potlatch, you know. Usually the chief would be the one to give the potlatch. He's supposed to provide most of the, you know, meat and stuff. But of course, everyone would donate. But it was supposed to be his thing, because he's supposed to, as a chief, go out in winter time and get a bear out of a hole, which was the big thing, because anybody could shoot a moose anytime, you know. It was no big deal. Caribou, same thing, but a bear, you have to be a real good hunter in order to get a bear out of a hole, and more so where you have to find the hole in winter time, you know. And of course, his wife has to be right there, you know, with her thing too, you know. She has to be the provider for the berries and the edible fish and all that stuff. Mm. And of course, the chief gives a big speech, you know, just before the potlatch.
People would come in from surrounding villages to share the festivities as they do now. Festivities that concluded with an old-time dance in the hall, a dance in the continuing series that began around Christmas time. These days, the emphasis might be more on rock and roll, but it's still a nightly event, and the idea behind all the celebrating is still the same.
You have to have a break, you know. You have to have a celebration. Can't work all the time.
There'll be a dance tonight in Nulato, and tomorrow night, and there was probably one last night as well. People, as Pauline Carlo said, just can't be working all the time. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.